I'm learning, so don't expect I'm going to be perfect on them, but I'm going to do my best. You don't have to stand. You want to stand up? All righty. Listen, if you know this one, you go ahead and sing along with me. If you don't know it, then let me sing it until you learn it, and then you can step in on the verses as you know them. This is number 8. I like John Newton's songs. Number 8 is one there is above all others. One there is above all others. Well deserves the name of friend. His is love beyond a brother's. Costly, free, and knows no end. They who once his kindness prove find it everlasting love. Which of all our friends to save us could or would have shed their blood? But our Jesus died to have us reconciled in him to God. This was boundless love indeed. Jesus is a friend indeed. Sorry. This is really an amateur time, isn't it? We're not even pretending to be professionals here. All right, see if you can follow along. When he lived on earth, a basin friend of sinners was his name. Now above all glory raised, he rejoices in the same. Still he calls them brethren, friends, and to all their wants attends. Could we bear from one another what he daily bears from us? Yet this glorious friend and brother loves us though we treat him thus. John Newton. All right, let's go to number 17. Deb says I've sung this before, but it's not marked in my list. So if you know it, sing it with me.
I heard the voice of Jesus say,
Jesus, and I found in him my star, my star.
One more. Let's see what we get here. How about number, where did I find that? Well, now I lost it. Okay. Let's do number 123. This might be a difficult one for me. Let's see.
Though the way we journey may be often drear, we shall see the King someday. On that blessed morning, clouds will disappear. We shall see the King someday. We shall see the King someday, when the clouds have rolled away. Gathered round the throne, then he shall call his own. We shall see the King someday. After pain and anguish, after toil and care, we shall see the King someday. See the King someday, when the clouds have rolled away. Gathered round the throne, when he shall call his own, we shall see the King someday.
Everybody,
there with all the loved ones who have gone before, we shall see the King someday. See the King someday, when the clouds have rolled away. Gathered round the throne, when he shall call his own, we shall see the King someday.
Amen. Peter Smith Sunday School. Well, I'm going to open it up for questions. So if you've got one, you got a chance now to ask it. Otherwise, I'm going to go with what I've got. All righty.
What's your thoughts about cremation?
Cremation. What are your thoughts about cremation? I'm not sure my thoughts are worth anything. The Bible doesn't say that it's wrong to cremate. I don't believe that it is wrong to cremate because the Bible just doesn't ever mention it. However, it has been brought out that that God disposed of Moses' body and God buried it.
Amen.
Which is, to me, an interesting thought, that God chose to bury Moses. Didn't tell us where he buried him. Probably because he didn't want people to worship at his grave, and they would have worshiped at Moses' grave. Moses was a big deal in that day, and God took Moses, says he died, and it says God buried him. Now, I don't have the verse on that, but you can look it up. It's toward the end of Deuteronomy. Anyway, in my mind, the Bible doesn't say that it's wrong to cremate. Cremation is a lot cheaper. And let me tell you something. If your body has been burned to a cinder, turned into ash, put into an urn, and it's on somebody's fireplace mantle, and that's the way it is, when God gets ready to resurrect that person, it's not a problem. God's got it all memorized. He has your DNA memorized. He knows exactly what you're like. And he's got all your memories and everything written down. It all is there. He can reconstitute you just like an insect comes out of the little cocoon that it has, comes out completely different than what it was, but it's the same exact body, the same exact DNA. God's going to do that whether you're cremated or not, whether you're buried at sea or whether you're incinerated or whether, you know, I don't care if you're dismembered or you're eaten by worms. It doesn't matter how it does, because it's not the physical molecules in your body that makes you. You are not the molecules in your body. The Bible talks about resurrection, and at that time it didn't seem possible. How could you resurrect? Because when the body disintegrates, it's gone. How can you ever get that back? But now we're not ignorant like they were back in those days, and we don't even have to rely on faith. We know exactly how that body can be reconstituted, because your body is genetic information. That's what it is. And God can make it again, and he can make it even better looking than you are now. He can make it right. That's something, isn't it? I don't know if that answers your question. I don't have a verse that tells you right or wrong. I know some people are against cremation because it's a pagan practice. But as far as I can tell, all kinds of practices are pagan practices. And even the pagans might land on a good idea once in a while, you know. So it's not impossible. I would need God to tell me it's wrong for me to preach that it's wrong. So I'm not going to tell you it's wrong. If you think it's a better deal, you don't want to pay for a graveyard, grave site, and have to go and clean the grave all the time, and you want to just cremate because it's, you know, 1/4 the price. Of course, if you cremate, if you decide to cremate and you decide to have a funeral in a funeral home and they're going to do the cremation, the cost comes out just about the same. So if you're going to cremate, then you need to just do your memorial service away from the funeral home and do it a lot cheaper if that's your purpose. But I'm not here to give it final day's advice. You guys make up your own minds however you want to do that. But the Bible doesn't say. Did that answer your question, Roland? Anybody else? It's going fast. Boy, you guys ought to come prepared with some messages. Otherwise, your eyes are going to glaze over because you're going to have to be listening to what I'm interested in. And if you have something you want me to talk about, then you come with the question, and boy, I'll deal with it the best I can. Otherwise, we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of what interests Bill Kincaid, and that can be, I mean, sometimes you guys talk about stuff that makes my eyes glaze over. So I don't really feel bad if I talk about stuff that makes your eyes glaze over. But I do have one. And this happened to be a question about Jethro, Moses' father-in-law. Somebody says, what about this? You know, what is this? And so I'm going to go over it. It also lands into my series that I was doing about a year ago, maybe a little longer, about secondary characters, peripheral characters, not the main protagonists of the Bible, not the Davids and the Moseses, but the other people that are associated with them, but that the Bible gives us some real information about. And so this happens to be one of my secondary characters to deal with. It's called Jethro, the father-in-law of Moses. So we're going to start in Exodus chapter 2. Look at verse 15. You remember the story of Moses. That's the primary character in the story. He killed a man. Then he was going to be in trouble for it. So he ran, and he gets somewhere in the area of Midian. And we don't know exactly where that is. Some people think it's in the Sinai Peninsula. Other people think it's in what now is Arabia. And I kind of lean toward the Arabia side of it, but there's no way to know for sure. One way or the other, he gets there, he sees a well, and he sits on the well. And I think that's interesting. He sits on a well, and he's got to be contemplating what in the world has happened to my life. I was an important person in Egypt, and here I am, 40 years old, running for my life. Anyway, he shows up there as an Egyptian. And in Exodus chapter 2, if you look at verse 15, it says, now when Pharaoh heard this thing, he sought to slay Moses, and Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian. And he sat down by a well. Now the priest of Midian had 7 daughters, And they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. And the shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. And when they came to Reuel, their father, he said, "How is it that ye are come so soon today?" And they said, "An Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds, and also drew water enough for us and watered the flock." And he said unto his daughters, "And where is he? Why is it that ye have left the man? Call him that he may eat bread." And Moses was content to dwell with the man, and he gave Moses Zipporah, his daughter. Now the first mention we have of this man is his name is Reuel, called Jethro in other places. In fact, in the next chapter says Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law. So his name is Jethro to most of us. Reuel is the first name. It's not a surprise that some people have more than one name. You have more than one name. So, no, it's not a big deal. I mean, when I was in high school, they called me Little Kincaid. Because I had an older brother who was regular Kincaid, I guess. So I was Little Kincaid. That's what they called me. Nobody called me Billy. Nobody called me Bill. Nobody called me Rocky. Nobody called me all my other names. But they called me Little Kincaid. Now, when somebody has two names, don't think, well, there's a problem with the Bible. No, there's no problem at all. It's just that some people have more than one name. That's just real simple. So, Reuel, or Jethro, is Moses' father-in-law. The first thing that we find out about him is that he's a priest of Midian. Who's Midian? Son of Abraham. Who said that? There you go. There's the guy who's been reading the Bible. Midian was one of these sons of Abraham. You didn't know Abraham had eight sons. Abraham had eight sons. Only one son, Isaac, was given his inheritance. All the other sons were sons of concubines, and they were sent away with gifts. So they all became big items in their respective places. Midian was one of Abraham's sons. He settled along the Arabian Peninsula. He settled out in that area, and possibly in the Sinai area also, I'm not sure. But Midian settled there and became a pretty good-sized people. We find them fighting the Midianites in the book of Judges. So Midianites, they were a wide-ranging group of people. According to most commentators, they were a nomadic people. Like the Bedouins, they would just roam and do their business they didn't settle down, although in some areas they did turn into some cities. They had some cities that were considered Midianite cities, but they were a pretty good size people group. This one was a priest of Midian. What do you think it means when it says he's a priest of Midian? You realize that there was still a remnant of people who worshiped the Creator God. They knew him as Allah or Elohim. They knew him as the Almighty God. They knew him as the Creator of all things. You remember when Abraham came back from the slaughter of the kings and that fella called Priest of the Most High God? He was the Priest of the Most High God. He came and blessed Abraham, and Abraham gave him tithes. Who was this Melchizedek? He was one of that remnant of people that were still worshiping the God of Noah and had not delved into these false gods. There was a group. In fact, there's a book on it. It's an old book back in the 1800s, written on the worship of the one true God in the time of the patriarchs. And he lists a bunch of different people in the Bible that's mentioned that points out that they are worshiping the one true God. Now, we know that Abraham's family had become idolatrous, because in Joshua it says that Abraham's parents worshipped idols, worshipped gods that were not gods, and Abraham was called out from that. So we know that there was idolatry in that group, but there were also still some people that still worshipped the one true God, and you'll find them scattered about in these patriarchal stories that include Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. You'll find them, and you will even find those that are idolatrous, they still honor this one true God. And we have prophets of this one true God scattered about. You remember Balaam? Balaam was a prophet of this one true God, and God sent him messages, and when Balak, the king, hired him to curse Israel, yeah, that's in the book of Numbers, when Balaam hired him to curse Israel, he tried to, and God wouldn't let him. Every time he opened his mouth, he was blessing Israel, and Balak got mad and said, "What are you doing? Every time I tell you to curse them, I'm paying you this, and you bless them, and you curse us." That's not working, because God wasn't letting him curse them. And he finally ends up saying, "You'll be cursed if you curse them, and you'll be blessed if you bless them." So that's an interesting thought. But just to point out that there were many different idolaters after the flood. You don't find idolatry before the flood. I don't find it. It doesn't mention it in any of the rebukes you find in the New Testament about the people before the flood. You don't find it in the text in Genesis. It doesn't mention idolatry. What it does mention is violence and fornication. That was before the flood. That was some horrible things that were, it was going on, and God said, "Man, these people are bad. All their thoughts are bad." That's why he wiped them out. But after the flood came a lot of idolatry, and they descended into idolatry pretty fast. Chances are the Midianites descended into idolatry pretty fast. But this fellow was a priest of Midian, and my guess is that he was somebody still connected to the one true God of Noah. Now that is somewhat speculation, but it's not impossible, because there were people that still had that belief. They weren't, at least they weren't as idolatrous as the other people around. This man is called a priest of Midian. Now, we find that he has seven daughters. Now, you might feel like, "Oh, bless his heart, all he had was daughters." Because back in those days, daughters were second class. Sorry, ladies. They're not second class anymore. Jesus put a stop to that. The New Testament puts a stop to that. Your daughters are just as valuable as your sons. Amen. And when it comes to actual civilizational advance, your daughters are more important than your sons. Amen. You need daughters, because they're the ones that bear the children. You don't need nearly as many men as you need women. Women are the ones that bring the next generation. So civilizationally, genetically, they're the more important ones. But at the same time, this fella, back in those days, I'm sure it was a disappointment to him if all he had was seven daughters. Turns out that's not the way he was. He had seven daughters, but that's not all he had. We find one of his sons later on. So he did have sons. It does say he had seven daughters, and the seven daughters were taking care of the sheep. I guess the sons were busy playing video games. And they put the daughters out there taking care of the sheep. And there were some shepherds out there that would make them wait at the well. Because back in those days, back in that area, you had to go to the well to get the water. It wasn't like you just go to the river, because there aren't any rivers over there. There's just, or not much. So they had to go to the well, and they had to draw water out of the well. Not the way we have a pump, you flip a switch. They had to drop buckets in there, and that's a lot of work. And they are pulling the water out, and they're putting it in these troughs and letting their sheep drink the water. Well, that's a lot of work. And if you've got a pretty good sized flock, you get there, you're wanting to water. Here comes some other people. They don't want to wait. And these are daughters, so they're pushed away. They're made them leave, get them out of the way so they can do theirs first, and then they just have to wait. And that's interesting, because Jacob did something similar for Rebecca. For Rachel. No, never mind. I'm getting all that mixed up. Just don't pay attention to any of that stuff. Just let's get back to what I'm talking about. It happened before in Genesis, but one way or the other, it happened here. Here's this Egyptian standing there, and he sees this thing going down, and he just steps in and tells those shepherds, "You just wait your turn." And then he helps them out, and he waters their flock. He was thinking, you know, "Lord," he's sitting on the well thinking, what in the world's going on with me? I had a great life, and this is what happened. I try to follow God, and it doesn't work out. And you know, sometimes you try to follow God, and it doesn't work out. Things just go south. And there he is, sitting by the well thinking, what am I supposed to do now? And then he found something he could do. There was some people that needed some help, and he helped them. And then they said, "Well, thank you," and they left. And it took their dad to say, "What do you mean? You just left him there?" bring him over. So they went and got him, and they sort of hit it off. This priest of Midian hit it off with Moses, and he gave him his daughter. I don't know which daughter. Gave him his daughter Zipporah. Anyway, I think that's very interesting. But we get to chapter 3 and verse 1. It says, Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the backside of the desert and came to the mountain of God, even to Horeb. Nobody knows where Horeb is. There's some people over there that say it's in the Sinai. I don't know. There are archaeologists that are still debating that. I don't think it really matters. Look at chapter 4 and verse 18. And Moses went and returned to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said unto him, Let me go, I pray thee, and return unto my brethren which are in Egypt, and see whether they be yet alive. And Jethro said to Moses, Go in peace. Now, it doesn't tell us the timeline here, but we're looking at 40 years between the time he saved those young ladies at the well, and he goes and meets the priest of Midian, and then he goes back on the backside of the desert, and he's married to this daughter. We don't know the timeline of what happened in that 40 years. It looks to me like he didn't get married to Zipporah right away. I think it happened in that 40 years, but it could be 10 years in, 20 years in. We know that during this time, he has a very young son, just one young son named Gershon. And he's very young, and he's just born, and that's at the 40-year mark. So Moses is 80 years old, and he has a very young son. So my guess is that he was with Jethro, his father, this friend of his, Jethro, in the desert, living with him until farther in, maybe 30 years in, and then he gets married to Zipporah, and then 5 years, 10 years, or 9 years later, he has a baby, and that's when God appears to him. He has a wife and a child, and God appears to him and says, Now I'm calling you. Now I want you to go do something in Egypt for me. And he convinces him, and he goes back to his father-in-law and says, Let me take your daughter on a mission. It's hard to give up your kids for a missionary project, right? Let me take your daughter on a mission. Now he says, I was in 18, says, And Jethro said to Moses, Go in peace. And the Lord said unto Moses in Midian, Go, return unto Egypt, for all the men are dead which sought thy life. And Moses took his wife and his sons. Oh, yeah, they were two sons by then. Okay, and set them upon an ass. And he returned to the land of Egypt. And Moses took the rod of God in his hands. Now, he goes on and tells you what he does and what he's supposed to do in Egypt. I'm just wanting you to focus on this secondary character. He takes this man, Jethro's daughter, and his grandchildren and takes them back into Egypt. But what you find out is, look in verse 24. And it came to pass by the way in the inn that the Lord met him and sought to kill him. All right, he's on the way back to Egypt, and he's got his wife and his sons with him, and he's heading back there, and he's at an inn. He's at a place where they're staying, and apparently God appears wanting to kill Moses. Now, you might say, what in the world is happening here? And I'm just going to let you know, nobody knows. We do not have any information more than you're reading right here. All it says is there is God, the angel of the Lord, going to kill him. And it says, And then Zipporah took a sharp stone and cut off the foreskin of her son and cast it at his feet and said, Surely a bloody husband thou art thou to me. And so apparently God let him go. Then she said, A bloody husband thou art, because of the circumcision. Now this tells us something. These Midianites were not circumcised. Now Abraham was circumcised, and he circumcised Ishmael. My assumption is that he circumcised Midian. And my assumption is that the Midianites were a circumcised people, that they took upon them, just like the Ishmaelites still are to this day, by the way. They are a circumcised people. And that means they had this special ritual for the male children when they were young, that they would cut off the foreskin, the extra skin on the male member of the child, and that made them have some sort of a covenant relationship with God. That was the idea. And My assumption is that Midian was also circumcised and that he would have taught that to his children, but apparently that got away from him because by this time they're not circumcised and they're not paying attention to that covenant relationship they had through Abraham, their father, or some type of connection to Abraham. They had lost all of that and Zipporah was against it. Now, you can read in this text, apparently, God had told him, and I'm reading between the lines, God had told Moses, you need to circumcise your sons. Moses was circumcised, you need to circumcise your sons. And so Moses goes to Zipporah and says, I'm going to circumcise my sons. And she says, oh no, you're not. It's all there. You can read it. It's in between the lines, but it's in there. Yeah. Zipporah says, no, she was against it. She disagreed with it. And the only reason she did it was because she didn't want Moses to get killed. When she saw the angel of the Lord ready to kill Moses because he didn't have control of his wife. There's an awful lot there, but we could preach there for a while. But I'm not going to get too much into that. I just want you to know that that's there in the text to some extent where you can see that Zipporah was against it. Moses was intending to do it. God was going to kill Moses. By the way, how important do you think you are? If God was ready to kill Moses, just how important do you think you are to God? God can raise somebody else up. If he can make stones shout out instead of the children of Israel, well, then you shouldn't be too big on yourself. Anyway, God was going to kill Moses. Zipporah didn't want God to kill Moses, so she herself circumcised her son and cast it at his feet with an anger. You people are barbaric. You notice that the Gentiles, the non-believing, they were what do you call it? More upper class. They were more highfalutin. They had better thoughts. They had better ideas than the believers. The believers were the backwards, bloody kind of people. It's not the way it is after the New Testament, but before the New Testament, that's the way it was. People saw the Jews as being very, very strange. They were a bloody, strange group of people. God said he wanted them to be strange. In the King James Bible, he calls them peculiar, which is his way of saying, you guys are a little off. You're peculiar. I mean, maybe he just meant that they were specially his, but at the same time, he made them different. He said, I want you to stand out among the people. I want them to very clearly distinguish you people from everybody else. So he made them dress different. He made them groom themselves different. He made things different for them. And they had this thing of circumcision, which to all of the Gentiles was a very bloody, horrible thing to do. So Zipporah puts up with that. She goes ahead and saves his life and circumcises her child, which tells us a little bit about this priest of Midian, this Jethro. He wasn't circumcised. He didn't circumcise his sons. He wasn't interested in it. He had raised his daughters right. He said, you're not going to be bloody and mean and, you know, just do these kind of things. And so it took a little bit of persuasion for Zipporah to go along with God's will or Moses' idea of circumcising his children. Now, the next time, we're skipping over an awful lot of history here, but the next time we find Jethro is in Exodus 18. I'm sorry. Yes, Exodus 18. By this time, Moses has brought out the people from Egypt. They're out. They came out with a high hand. God delivered them. The entire army of Egypt was destroyed. Pharaoh himself drowned in the Red Sea, and they are now walking through the wilderness. They've got a pillar of fire by day and by night, and a pillar of cloud by day leading them. They've got manna appearing every morning, and they're eating to their heart's content. They have all that they need to eat. They have quail fly in every so often and give them meat to eat. They're being taken care of. They're getting water out of a rock that's taking care of all of their flocks, turns into a river right out there in the middle of the desert. These are some amazing things. And Jethro hears. When Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, and that the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt, then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he had sent her back. Now, here you got some information. While Moses is in Egypt doing all these plagues and everything else, he says, I tell you what, Zipporah, you head on back. Now, I don't know whether she was upset, which sounds like that's a possibility, that she had that kind of attitude. I don't like this. I don't like what we're doing. I don't know what we're doing here. What's the deal? What's too many mosquitoes? I don't know what her complaints were. But Moses says, I tell you what, why don't you just head on back to your dad and I'll take care of this by myself. No problem. And it didn't say it in the story, but it tells us here by means of just an incidental mentioning of it. Says Moses had sent her back. So she's there with Jethro, and then Jethro hears. And her two sons, that's in verse 3, of which the name of one was Gershom, for he said, I have been an alien in a strange land. That's why he named him Gershom. And the name of the other was Eliezer, for the God of my father said he was mine help, means help, and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife unto Moses into the wilderness, where he encamped at the Mount of God. And he said unto Moses, I, thy father-in-law, Jethro, am come unto thee and thy wife and her two sons with her. Now, just get the idea of what's happening here. This is a huge camp. This is a huge camp. They've got all kinds of tents and camps, and they're set up by companies, by their tribes, and they're lined out. It's all very organized. They've got their sheep and their other cattle. They're all on the outsides of the camp, and they've got the roads in the camp. Everywhere they camp, whether it was for a month or 2 months or, you know, 6 months, however long they would camp there, they set it up right. This was an organized thing. And, here comes this Midianite. And he has to send word into the camp. He doesn't say he's going to walk on in there. He has to send word and say, it's Jethro, your father-in-law. Can we come in? And they go get him and they bring him in. Now, verse 5. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife unto Moses into the wilderness, where he encamped at the Mount of God. And he said unto Moses, I, thy father-in-law, Jethro, am come unto thee and thy wife and her two sons with her. And Moses went out to meet his father-in-law and did obeisance and kissed him. And they asked each other of their welfare, and they came into the tent. And Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done unto Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, and all the travail that had come upon them by the way, and how that the Lord delivered them. And Jethro rejoiced for all the goodness which the Lord had done to Israel, whom he had delivered out of the hands of the Egyptians. And Jethro said, Blessed be the Lord who hath delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of Pharaoh, who hath delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all gods, for in the thing wherein they dwelt, wherein they dealt proudly, he was above them. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and sacrifices for God. And Aaron came and all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law before God. I consider this sort of a conversion experience for Jethro. Jethro goes and Moses tells him everything that happened from chapter 4 of Exodus through chapter 12 of Exodus, all those plagues, all the stuff. You know, Moses tells Jethro all of this stuff, and then he tells him how they were drowned and how they got out, and everything's been great up to now. And Jethro is amazed because these people defeated the Egyptians. The Egyptians ruled the world at that time. All of those areas were under the thumb of Egypt. They were the greatest power in the world at that time. And so when the Egyptians were defeated by this group, Jethro says, wow, this is just really amazing. This is what God has done. When it says Lord there, it's talking about the word Jehovah. When you see in the King James Bible, it has L-O-R-D, all in capital letters. That's the word Jehovah. They've reduced it to the word Lord because Jesus did in the New Testament. Every time he quotes the Old Testament, he changes it to Lord. So our translators did that same thing. You can disagree with that. I don't care. I'm going to let the Bible just say it the way it says it. It's not hiding anything. It's all in caps. That's the word Jehovah. And what Jethro does is he says, Jehovah is above all gods. How did he know that? Because the 10 Egyptian plagues was a perfect example of
about how the God of the Israelites destroyed the gods of Egypt. If you'll look at those plagues, they have to do with the gods that the Egyptians worshipped. The God of the Nile, it turned into blood. The God of the sun, it was dark. The God of there's other things. The God of rain, the God of the wind, the God, all of these gods that they worshipped were completely destroyed by the God of the Israelites. And so Jethro says, obviously, this God defeated all of their gods. So this is the one true God. Doesn't that look like a conversion moment? But he didn't get circumcised. He didn't join the covenant. He didn't become an Israelite. That's interesting to me. So he becomes converted, but doesn't become a covenant member. Now, to me that's interesting because some people are saved that aren't members of that covenant, which gives a problem to some people that think that salvation was through that covenant. And even in the New Testament, it says pretty clear that salvation's not even in that covenant, that these sacrifices can't take away sin, and that covenant was just in there just for meanwhile, and there's a lot of things said about that old covenant, the one that God gave to Moses, and so don't overemphasize that covenant of Moses. Jethro came, he didn't join the covenant, but it looks to me like he was converted to the one true God, and he made a sacrifice to that God. That to me seems like a conversion experience. Now look at chapter 18, verse 17. And Moses' father-in-law said unto him, the thing that thou doest is not good. He starts giving him some advice. Remember, he's a priest of Midian, means he's a big shot. He already has some ruling experience. He has some experience at being a leader of his people. And he sees Moses, and Moses sat in his judgment seat all day from early in the morning till late at night while people stood in line waiting to talk to him to get some resolution of some dispute they had. And Jethro watches this, and when Moses gets done for that day, he says, you know, you gotta rethink this. This is not working. And he gives him some advice. He says, thou wilt surely wear away both thou and this people that is with thee, for this thing is too heavy for thee. Thou art not able to perform it thyself alone. Hearken now unto my voice, and I will give thee counsel, and God shall be with thee. Be thou for the people to Godward, that thou mayest bring the causes unto God, and thou shalt teach them ordinances and laws, and shalt show them the way wherein they must walk, and the work that they must do. Moreover, thou shalt provide out of all the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them to be rulers of thousands and rulers of hundreds and rulers of fifties and rulers of tens, and let them judge the people at all seasons. And it shall be that every great matter shall they bring unto thee, but every small matter they shall judge. And if you go on, you'll see that they did that. And it worked out better, and they kept that. By the way, that's just the simple system, a federated system where you have different jurisdictions. And so you have people who are heads of 1,000 people, and he's got certain requirements. And then you have people that are heads of 100 people, and they got certain requirements and certain decision making. It's just how you organize your jurisdictions. We do that here in the United States. All governments do it. You have to. It works really well. You only take to the Supreme Court the very final problems. You don't take it to the small claims court. You don't take small claims stuff to the Supreme Court, right? That's what Moses had to learn. And Moses was doing all this the hard way, and Jethro, his father-in-law, helped him organize the judgment, which I think it's interesting. He organizes a justice system, and Moses imposes it on them. Now look at verse 27. And Moses let his father-in-law depart, and he went his way into his own land. He left. He didn't. He converted to the true God, but he didn't join the covenant, and he didn't go with them. So you think this is the end of the story, right? And it's almost the end of my hour. So I'm gonna give you a heads up on what's coming next week. You had your chance to ask questions. Now you don't even have the chance next week because I'm gonna finish this study. Anyway, I just want you to know Jethro goes back to his own land. Turn to Numbers chapter 10 and verse 29 to get us ready for next week. Numbers chapter 10 and verse 29. If your eyes are glazing over, now you know how I feel when you talk to me about Pokemon cards or whatever it is that you're talking about. 10:29, I said, and Moses said unto Hobab, the son of Raguel, the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law, R-A-G-U-E-L, I think is the same name as Ruel, R-E-U-E-L, very similar. Maybe not. It's not impossible for a man to have three names, but if it might just be a different spelling of that other name that we had seen, Ruel. So we have Ruel, we have Raguel, and we have Jethro, but this guy's the Moses' father-in-law. And who is this Hobab? Well, Hobab is his son, meaning this brother-in-law of Moses was there. Jethro, his father-in-law, had left, and Hobab had hung around and seen some more, and Hobab is getting ready, I guess, himself to leave. Let's go ahead and read the rest of it. We are journeying unto the place, Moses said to Hobab, we are journeying unto the place of which the Lord said, I will give it you. Come thou with us, and we will do thee good, for the Lord hath spoken good concerning Israel. And he said unto him, I will not go, but I will depart to my own land and to my kindred. And he said, leave us not, I pray thee, for as much as thou knowest how we are to encamp in the wilderness, and thou mayest be to us instead of eyes. And it shall be, if thou go with us, yea, it shall be, that what goodness the Lord shall do unto us, the same will we do unto thee. You don't have to convert. You don't have to become part of the covenant. You don't have to circumcise. Just go with us, and we'll let you be one of the strangers that are traveling with us. You'll be one of us, but because you're a Midianite, and the Midianites were a traveling type of a people, they were nomadic, desert-dwelling people, he said, you would be a great help to us because you can give us insight on what we're doing. And it doesn't say that, but it's clear that he did stay with him. Hobab went ahead and went with him and helped him out while they were in their wilderness wanderings, which was actually quite important. Now, I just want to point out, what did I get to? Verse 32. Yeah, we'll do unto thee. He says, we'll make sure that whatever blessings God gives the Israelites, he also gives, we give those blessings to you as well, even though you're not exactly a member of the covenant. You're not part of us exactly, but all our blessings you will get too, because you're on our side. Now, I want to point out, look at Judges chapter 1 and verse 16. It comes down to the point. Judges 1:16 says, and the children of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, went up out of the city of palm trees, that's Jericho, with the children of Judah into the wilderness of Judah, which lieth in the south of Arad, and they went and dwelt among the people, which is the way that they would say these people went and dwelt in the amongst the tribe of Judah. But they weren't part of the tribe of Judah. They dwelt among them. They weren't part of the covenant. They just dwelt among them. And it calls them Kenites, which is very interesting. I know your eyes are glazing over, but to me this is very interesting because Kenites are not mentioned here only. Kenites are mentioned several other places. I'm just going to list them off so that you can think about it. If you do any thinking about it at all during the week, you can think about it. And next Sunday, I'm going to start here and we're going to go farther. Kenites was one of the 10 nations mentioned, one of the 10 nations that God said Abraham's seed was going to dispossess in Genesis chapter 15. One of those 10 nations was Kenites. You have the Kenites, the Kenizzites, the Keboites, the Hivites, and then six of the seven nations that they actually did dispossess. 10 nations back in Abraham's time, 430 years later, it was only seven nations, and the difference is Hivites. I asked my robot friend whether Hivites were the Kenites and all that, and they said, no, it was just a difference. They're not the same. So I'm not absolutely sure what it is, But Kenites already existed. Apparently, they were one of the clans of the Midianites that were dwelling in the area that Abraham was going to possess. And by the time that Moses comes around, the people that were in that area that Abraham was going to possess were those seven nations, including the Girgashites, the Jebusites, the Canaanites, the Amorites, the Hittites, the Hivites, and the Perizzites. If you get all of those together, you'll find they were in that position. So in 400 years, there had been some shifting, and the Kenites weren't there anymore. Where were the Kenites? Well, they were Midianites, part of the group of Midianites, and they were now down over there in the Arabian area, south of Arabia. And the Kenites were part of the Midianites, one section of the Midianites. And we'll get into that on next week, since we're running out of time. Just want you to know, just to point out, that Balaam mentions the Kenites when he mentions all those nations that are going to be destroyed from among the people of Israel. The Kenites were one of the ones that Balaam mentioned when Balak got all upset and said, "You're just cursing us. I tell you to curse them and you curse all of us." And that's one of them was the Kenites. But the Kenites that wound up dwelling with Israel were that special group, were children of Hobab, the son of Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, that did not assimilate into Israel, but they lived among them. They began among them in amongst the Judahites in the south of Israel. And they lived as sort of a nomadic type of a group of people. They would occupy sometimes some cities or whatever, but they didn't settle down like the Israelites did. But they were Kenites, and they're specially mentioned in the Bible, and they are children of Jethro, are descendants of Jethro, Moses' father-in-law. All right, we'll get into that next week. Can't wait!